Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hi, we're back, and we got Matt has finished solving all the drug problems in Bolivia and Peru and Central America. I mean, you were just out there kicking ass and taking names, weren't you, brother?
Trying. Sometimes.
I tell you, it's just so exciting. But next up, you decide that, well, that's not enough, so I think I'll go live in the overseas environment, right?
I was excited to get to Bogota. I really wanted to go to Bogota, and I was blessed again in my career to get that assignment. And of course, you go in there and there's teams, there's rivalries going on, which I thought was kind of funny, yeah. Which I'm sure you were aware of. You had the Medellin group and mm-hmm. You had the Cali group, and now things had shifted. When I come in, they had shifted from your time, right? And
right. And
your incredible success of getting Pablo and all of that. And now it's on to the Cali cartel.
Mm-hmm.
So the remnants of the Medellin, you know, investigations, they're still ongoing, right? They're still
just
because you killing Pablo was one of the greatest events in our history of DEA. The investigations don't stop.
Right.
Right. So there's the Medellin group still cleaning up. And then we come in and Chris Feistel and Dave Mitchell had beaten Jerry Salome and, mm-hmm. and Tim Cormack, just an array of just incredible people,
studs
who had all been there, you know, and I came in and so we were in the process. Now I step in and here we are, we're trying to hunt down the communications director of the Cali cartel. There's still major Cali cartel players to be grabbed and stuff. And so we're going back and forth from Cali. We're going on Sunday, we're flying out and then we're staying till Thursday or Friday and then flying back in the weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, back in Bogota. So because when I first got there, we couldn't stay there. There was still way too much heat with the Cali cartel. But later we did ultimately move on to the Bloque de Búsqueda, onto their base. And then we actually ended up getting an apartment in Cali and staying in an apartment. But, you know, it was insane work. I look back by the grace of God.
Exactly.
And I know you know this, Steve. What were we doing? When I think back, I don't think I would have ever done probably as much as 50% of what I did.
Mm-hmm.
No. I mean, I just, when I think back on how edgy it was and how dangerous and how much trust we put into our Colombian National Police counterparts who did a phenomenal job.
Yeah.
They really were phenomenal in most cases, right? But Cali, it was interesting. We had, I'll tell you a quick story, which was funny too, because you have these checks and balances, right? Things happen and all of a sudden you sit back and you're like, oh, we need to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
We had an agent from New York come down who was involved in a big investigation in Cali. And now I'd been there maybe a year and a half. So we're feeling very comfortable in Cali, right?
Yeah.
And so we're at an outdoor cafe, downtown Cali, Colombia. It's myself, it's Chris Feistel and Dave Mitchell. And then you've got this agent from New York and we're sitting there.
And you guys are obviously gringos.
Oh, and we're total gringos. And we're sitting there and the New York agent, he says to us, he's like, it appears to me that this might be a little dangerous. We're DEA agents in Cali, Colombia. And so, and we're like, yeah, this probably isn't the smartest thing in the world, but it's a nice place, nice sights. So we're right downtown Cali and stuff. So, and you're kind of like, I thought about that for years, that comment, because we did a lot of things. When we would get in taxis, of course, all the taxis had, the Cali cartel had given, every taxi in Cali had a separate, they had two radios. So the minute we'd get in, we'd get in the taxi and we'd say, go ahead, call them, tell them where we're at. We know. But you know who we have to thank? And God rest his soul. And you know this, Steve, that the horrible capture and murder of Kiki Camarena, the reaction of DEA to that globally and the actions that we took, because like you, we came in a couple years after that, but it was still actively investigating for the next 15 years, anyone associated with anything to do with that kidnapping and and murder. We know from intercepts that all over the world, especially in Latin America, in Mexico, and in Colombia, that the drug traffickers were saying, don't make a DEA agent bleed.
Mm-hmm.
Don't touch a DEA agent.
Yep. That's exactly right.
Because of Kiki Camarena and the reaction to that. Am I not correct, right? It was
absolutely.
Yeah.
A lot of the talks that Javier and I do now, this is our ninth year of still telling the story, believe it or not. And that question will come up. How did you guys survive? Think about, why are the drug traffickers in business to start with? It's about the money. It's about the power. It's about the ego, the greed. And so when you see what happened with Kiki, where they shut down the border between Mexico and the United States, it was only for a day or two. But that stops them from being able to do what they're in business to do. So the last thing they want to do is bring so much heat and attention to themselves that they can't make the money. That's what it's all about.
Yeah,
and you're absolutely right. We give Kiki all the credit
for
keeping us alive.
That's right. That's right.
So
Bogota was a great experience. You know, it taught me, it was my first really permanent overseas. Snowcap wasn't near as much dealing with counterparts, especially with national police forces and, their various components. But it was a great experience operating in that, again, kind of a task force environment, but overseas. And going to the funerals, as you remember, funeral after funeral after funeral of Colombian National Police being killed, kidnapped, murdered, family murdered over and over again was just heartbreaking. It personally gave me just that much more incentive, obviously, to keep the drugs from getting into the U.S., but also at the same time, doing something for this great country of Colombia, because I loved Colombia. I loved the people. Everywhere I worked overseas, I loved the people, and you cut through all of that misinformation about the violence and some of the hate and everything, and the reality is most of these countries have just incredibly great people. Latins alone are incredible family people. Loved it. Loved integrating with them in my overseas assignments. So
good to hear you say that. It was, Javier and I went to a funeral one time, 8 police officers, a major and 7 others. It's just heartbreaking. They don't hold back. It's the other police officers, they're all just breaking down. This was what surprised me, because afterwards we went with some of the guys that we worked with in Dejín. We go over to a little cafe and you have a cold drink there and just sitting around. And I'm saying, I'm sorry for what happened to these guys. And they look at me and they're like, okay, Pena, it's over.
No, that's right. That's what was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, okay, it happened. We're moving on.
Yep. I was shocked. It's a different world, but you're right.
Yeah,
Colombia's beautiful. Beautiful.
Different world.
So from there, you got involved with that agency thing somehow, didn't you?
Yeah. So, it was interesting. Jim Kibble went over to the agency as a detailee for DEA to the CIA. And they started this program. We called it the cross-fertilization program. And, Jim had reached out and said, I think you might be a good candidate. Of course, you got to get through the polygraph and, things of that nature, the process. And so I went through the process and got through the polygraph, the very, very complicated, difficult polygraph. That it's actually 2 polygraphs. It's lifestyle, and then it's counterintelligence.
Yeah.
And the fact that I had been overseas and I had done snowcap, I don't think complicated is the right word, but it just meant I was in a non-CIA environment overseas, not following some of their regulations and processes. So that had to be translated into a way to get through the polygraph. So, which went fine, and I got through it. Started this journey. Went to their headquarters, of course, and did some rotation in the headquarters. At the same time, it's like taking college classes. I had to take some report writing classes and a program manager course, things of that nature. And then, of course, you go to the operations course. We went to the operations course accelerated.
That's at the farm.
Well, it's funny. We say the farm. Yeah, part of it's at the farm. Right. I can't really get into too much, but it involves much more of the United States than just the farm.
Yeah.
It's some of the greatest training I could have ever had in my life. It's very, very, very cerebral, very detail focused. Every little detail is so significant, because one little mistake and someone potentially dies, an asset potentially dies. And they go to great, great lengths to protect that. probably some of the greatest professionals, intellectuals I've ever been around in government. DEA is incredible, right? We have great people and smart people. It's very different in the CIA, because you have to be trained in a little different mindset.
Mm-hmm.
They're not out trying to engage or involved in violent activity all the time, right? They want to do everything in the shadows, and you're taught to do things around corners and do things very quickly and briefly, in a way that keeps everybody safe from any type of exposure. Highly complicated, but it is so rewarding to have gotten through that. And there were other classes. I took counterterrorism operations course that they gave, and that was fascinating, because they incorporate all of the various terrorist groups around the world, and you get great insight as to the successes and failures of how they operate, of how they operated and how they were taken down and how they infiltrated or not or whatever. So,
mm-hmm.
And all this is, you can Google any of what I'm saying about this. And then I got deployed overseas, which was great. I was in station overseas and worked, for CIA. It was a great experience, and did that for a few years, and doing God's work, as we say, for God and country. But at the same time, a lot of liaison, working very closely with, at the time, Fujimori was the president. Montesinos was
in Peru, right?
Yeah, was the national security advisor. And there was just a lot going on at the time. The Japanese ambassador takeover had just ended when I had arrived. So there was cleanup going on with that. And I was engaging with DEA on various cases and things, trying to give some insight and some kind of collaborative guidance to DEA on cases. Mm-hmm. But of course, you have to be very, very careful. A lot of sensitivities, obviously, around what the CIA does. They have an incredible liaison program where they're working with host country nationals, just like the other agencies do. It's just done, obviously, in a more private, I'll say secretive way, kind of. I mean, a lot of them are declared.
Oh, yeah.
So it was an amazing experience, is the bottom line. And I got to carry that hat, ended up back with DEA to my next assignment into headquarters from there. But took that whole CIA mindset and was able to apply that for the rest of my career. Even now, I'm applying a lot of that, and a lot of the people that I work with. I never lost touch with them. You don't. Because yeah. It's really something very special. And Jim Kibble did such a great job. He was loved over there. Such a great job representing DEA. So it was a great honor for me to be involved in that.
When you were working with them, were you in the embassy in Peru? You're in Lima, yeah. Right?
I was in Lima, in the embassy. And, well, not in the embassy a lot, because
yeah.
I was out in the field directly working with teams, with various teams that supported.
You know, it just makes CIA sense. And for those of our listeners here that have heard Javier and I talk, sometimes we kind of bash on the CIA a little bit. We have a little bit of fun with their initials. But here's the truth is we did not get along with the chief of station in Bogota. It was a nasty competition that, I mean, he treated us like bastard children, just to be quite honest with you, and we had no respect for him. The worker bees we got along fine with out in the field, but that was not an issue whatsoever. But here's my real feeling about the CIA. I think they do a phenomenal job myself. The thing is, they're secret. They can't tell us what they do, and I don't want them to tell us what they do, because then they won't be successful anymore. So the politicians like right. to bash, everybody likes to bash the CIA. It's because they're not in a position to defend themselves, and that's...
No, that's right, and they don't get credit for the successes, but you're 100% right, though, about it's all individual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people in the CIA will tell you there are people in the CIA that they don't like. They all have... They have leadership that can go sideways too, and just like all the agencies, right?
And very political.
I was really, really fortunate and blessed to have two really good chiefs of station
mm-hmm.
that I split during my time, and I got to see really what great work is going on that I will never talk about, never can. But it makes me proud, and I sleep easy at night knowing that the CIA is out there doing a very dangerous, secretive job all over the world. So, and DEA, but yet I did understand some of DEA's issues. I understood the concerns of DEA not being able to obtain information related to certain things. I saw information that was related to certain things. Couldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Couldn't share because,
yeah.
I mean, of course, terrorism trumps everything.
For sure.
Counterintelligence and terrorism are big trumpers. So just the answer is it is what it is.
Yes, it is. And that, and you just have to understand that. Do we like it? Not always. But.
And that program, I think that went away a while ago.
Which I think is horrific that they did that. I mean,
I haven't heard of it happening in a long, long time. So maybe,
you know,
they just got smarter about it. I don't know. But
one thing that always amazed me is that you look at the FBI in Washington and the army of people they have, agents assigned to Capitol Hill. And then you look at DEA and our Congressional and Public Affairs and what we had one person. And we wonder why we can't get ahead. I mean, this is not rocket scientists. If this redneck hillbilly can figure out, maybe if we had more people up there, we'd have more support from our congressional leaders.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's don't go down that road. I get frustrated. Yeah.
Exactly. We haven't even gotten to my epic time. So that's.
So you end up in headquarters after your CIA right?
Yeah. So I've done, you know, my overseas, I've done Colombia, I've done Peru. And of course, now it's time. I rotate into headquarters to get my headquarters time. So I'm now a supervisor assigned to the Mobile Enforcement Regional Enforcement Team program. Mm-hmm. And which I, you and I were talking, a lot of people don't know much about it. It was short-lived in a sense, maybe 5 years, congressionally mandated program, special funding. I thought it was one of the most effective operations DEA ever came up with to deal with local violent drug trafficking and crime associated with drugs in cities that were getting overwhelmed. We would take these MET teams, this very well, you ran one, these teams in various cities, a chief of police, state police, the governor's office could make a special request for a MET team who would come into the city. They would come into a community that had been devastated by drug trafficking or overrun by gangs or whatever. Very dangerous work. And these teams, these mobile enforcement teams, a team would come in and they would stay there 30, 60, 90 days, as long as it took, make undercover buys, work with the locals, use their intelligence to identify people, create an environment by which you could go and round up all these individuals, these 40, 50, 60 individuals, and take some, all of them federal on conspiracy charges or whatever, get them some real time. These are violent criminals. These aren't pot smokers on the corner or something like that. These are violent trafficking offenders who are destroying cities and communities. And it was always so rewarding for me as a staff coordinator to be working with all the supervisors out there running these teams. And the teams were generally well-funded, but the one thing was the fact that these individuals were doing sometimes weeks, sometimes months away from their families in undercover environments. Some of the most dangerous environments that DEA has ever been part of. The shootings that occurred in DEA, a lot occurred on MET enforcement operations. So I was proud of that. And then there was a RET program. Regional enforcement teams were developed. There were a few of those scattered throughout the country that worked just like a MET team, but on a regional basis, could respond within a whole part of the United States to do somewhat of the same thing. So a great program.
Yeah, it's almost like the RETs were almost like a reactionary force, a rapid deployment force send into a hot hotbed.
And you ran a MET team. I mean, did I sum that up?
You did. It was I loved it. It's one of the, I did it for 2.5 years. I ran the one for Atlanta Division, which was Georgia, Tennessee, North Carolina, South Carolina. We typically would go 4 to 6 months. Didn't hurt that Frankie Schroyer was, when he was head of the program in headquarters, he was.
That's who I worked for, yeah.
So he was head of the MET team in Atlanta before I took over.
That's
so
right.
We might got a little special consideration there when it came to funding, but it's one of those programs where you felt like you really made an impact on a local community. And you're going after, we would go after murderers, people with prior convictions for murder, kidnapping, torturing, maiming, bank robbery. I mean, these were the worst of the worst, and that's what the whole program was about. It wasn't your big drug traffickers. But
that's
the key,
right. You
hit the nail on the head, because a lot of the MET, not to point the finger at anybody else, but a lot of the METs just went in and did small substantive cases, not going for the conspiracy charges. we kind of mandated that in the Atlanta Met that we're gonna do the drug buys with small buys, but you're gonna build a conspiracy case to go along with it. Yeah. And then you're looking at 10 to life, 20 to life, 30 to life.
That's right.
I thought it was an extremely successful program, and it certainly built up the credibility of the federal agencies with the state and locals in the different states you went to.
Right. Great program. And then after that, I mean, I was actually very fortunate. People would always bust on me because, you know, I went into headquarters, did like just about 2 years under MetRet, went out as the resident agent in charge of Raleigh, North Carolina, again, for Dave Gaddis. And I did that for almost 2 years, went back to headquarters as a horse holder for Cindy Ryan, the chief counsel, and then went back out. So it was in and out twice when some people that were still trying to get out from their first one. Because, of course, nobody wants to be in headquarters. It's important. Right. It's an important part of the learning process, and to learn to be an executive and a leader, you've got to have those type of tours in and around the headquarters element, not necessarily in the building, but to have that experience right in Northern Virginia or DC area. So
not to mention the connections you make so that when you go back at the field, you know somebody everywhere around the world.
That's right. That's exactly right. So Raleigh was great. It was interesting because you know this very well. When I went to Raleigh, when it was 2002, I was there, and that's when there was the massive surging of drugs through Atlanta had been just out of control.
Yeah.
The Colombians were working now with the Mexicans. The Mexicans were moving massive loads through Atlanta using North Carolina to stockpile. And Atlanta was, you were overrun. Mm-hmm. There weren't enough agents in the country to deal with the problem going on. As you saw, you were there.
Major transshipment point.
And we were doing the same thing, and we were seizing money. Of course, the pipeline operations of seizing money were massive in North Carolina. I mean, you had troopers that, they just, I don't know, they had a gift. They could just sniff a car that had money. They became famous. They became legendary in the North Carolina State Police. These troopers that just, I mean, it was just crazy. Tens of millions of dollars they were seizing. So that went well. I enjoyed that.
One of those troopers was Tim Cardwell, who he and I are still... He was here for a conference in Orlando a month ago. We got to go have lunch together. We stay in touch, and just that guy didn't even need a drug dog.
Right.
Unbelievable.
No, we had a couple of those in North Carolina, these guys. Matter of fact, I brought one in to become a task force agent.
Yeah.
He was so good at what he did. I said, well, you can keep doing what you're doing, but come and be a task force agent with DEA so we can bridge all that information and everything you're doing. And that worked out really well. But he was legendary.
Yeah. Those guys are unbelievable. So now you've been in Raleigh, and you've done your headquarters twice, and you're tired. You're ready to go back overseas again, huh?
Yeah. Well, and then I went from North Carolina. I shot back in as the horse holder to Cindy Ryan, chief counsel. And the timing on that was actually interesting because that was right in the, well, towards the latter part, I should say, of the Purdue Pharma investigation. And so I was privy to all of that investigation, the history of it, and where the decision-making process and where we went to resolving it. And of course, diversion. I think Joe Ranazzisi was running diversion at the time, at least part of the time of the Purdue Pharma case.
He's another legend in DEA.
Legend. Brilliant.
Yeah.
Just brilliant.
He can't dumb it down enough for me to understand what he talks about most of the time.
He's just brilliant. Right place, right time. DEA needed him so bad in the position he was in. He couldn't get out of that position if he wanted to because he was too valuable.
Yeah. Our listeners, Purdue Pharma, now what are they infamous for?
OxyContin.
There you go.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot we could go. That's a discussion in and of itself.
Yeah. That's probably one better had in the bar than on the show.
No, exactly. Yeah.
You're going overseas again. How did you get interested in this next country?
Well, it was interesting. So I was on the eighth floor with Cindy Ryan, administrator's floor. And so I'm sorry, 12th floor. Boy, see what time does to the brain? So I was on the 12th floor. And so I was always running into Ferguson, who was the chief of operations at the time. And, and in these meetings, and I had already said that, cause I was told that with these positions, horse holder positions, that give me an idea where you're interested in going. And I had said Mexico. I'd done Peru. I had done Colombia. Why not do the trifecta? Our friend El Chapo was running around creating havoc, and I thought it'd be great to be part of that hunt. You know, he had been out, in and out of prison a couple times. So Mike Ferguson, another just smart guy, great legend.
Very.
He, all of a sudden, a position came open. And he said, he goes, Matt, and I had been with the chief counsel, I think, maybe a year and a half. He said, a position's open. He goes, if you're interested, I'll support you. So wow. I put in and got it. Was
chief operations support. It's a pretty good shot. Yeah. You're going to get it.
No, right. So I went over and it was just incredible. You talk about how outstanding it was that I had some CIA experience and Colombia and, you know, Peru, because this was the epicenter to me of just insanity of drug trafficking and violence and everything. Although Mexico, I can tell you, is probably one of the greatest places I've ever been, though. I loved Mexico.
Really?
I loved the people. I loved the food. I loved everything about it. And of course, my association with the violence was directly in relation to the investigations that we were doing. Generally speaking, Mexico is absolutely misunderstood by so many Americans. It's a beautiful, amazing country. So I loved it. But boy, you know, I had the fugitive apprehension team underneath me. So we were hunting fugitives from the United States all over the country.
That's always fun.
I had Diversion was under me at the time. And it was interesting because, and if people don't know, Diversion, piece of the agency that the diversion of controlled substances, OxyContin drugs, prescription drugs, precursor chemicals used to make drugs and things like that being diverted into an illicit market. Basically, Diversion does that. And Diversion investigates all the pharmacies for compliance with the schedule of 1, 2, 3, and 4 narcotics sold at Walgreens and CVS. They do audits to make sure that everything's kosher and the prescriptions that are written are appropriate, et cetera.
Right.
Just as a little background.
There you go.
So at the time, methamphetamine is surging in the U.S. when I was in Mexico. And the administrator had wanted to create programs to deal with this in Mexico because, you know, the super labs were popping up in the northern part of Mexico, and then they were making the meth, bringing it into the U.S. So we developed, and I was part of a whole program to develop teams, methamphetamine response teams in Mexico by the Mexicans, training them, special vehicles, special training to identify the precursor chemicals. But during all of that, it was interesting. What we learned was the precursor chemicals were being shipped in and they were being diverted, and the amount of legitimate precursor chemicals being brought into Mexico far exceeded the requirements of the documents associated with the ill, with those being sick and the distribution of meds, because the precursor chemicals used in meth are used, as we know, in cold medicines and things, Theraflu and things of that. So it was interesting. That led to a whole program that became really, really well received in Washington, was to limit the amount of precursor chemicals legitimately being brought into Mexico.
Especially ephedrine.
That's right. Well, it was really ephedrine was what started it. So we got ephedrine in control. And you know all this because of your positions in DEA. You and I had, it's interesting because we had access to all the same information throughout our careers. We kind of paralleled along.
Right.
So Mexico was great. I can't say enough about that work. I mean, it was dangerous. The Sinaloa cartel was wreaking havoc. All the cartels, but Sinaloa, Chapo Guzman hunting him. And it was fascinating because we would hit farms where we had information he was there. We would hit apartments. And there were little, we had a finca, and the problem was corruption, because we'd hit it. There would be food cooking on the stove.
Yeah.
And we knew he was there. And he got out right before we got there. Kind of like probably your Pablo Escobar time, you know, it's so frustrating. That was my final big overseas assignment. And then from there.
Well, how long were you in Mexico?
Just about 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as an assistant regional director, that's a GS-15 rating, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's
sure
for our listeners that we would call that an assistant special agent charge or an ASAC.
Yeah. And then I went and became the ASAC from there into a Boston field division, where I worked for Steve Durr.
Oh,
so
yeah, I remember Steve.
Steve brought me in. So Steve
that
and
was...
Steve and I had a great, you know, we had a really good relationship because Steve, again, was somebody who he told it like it is. He said it direct.
He still does.
Yeah.
Which I admire about him.
Well, that's what I loved about him. I didn't have time to sit and have tea and talk about stuff. Just tell me what you expect of me. And Steve would tell you exactly what he expected of you and demanded of you. And if you didn't do it, he'd tell you why.
Yeah.
You know?
You're going to hear about it.
And so we got along very well. And to this day, we're friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I know some people he rubbed the wrong way, but those are typically the people that don't respect direct talk.
That and people that aren't maybe your heaviest hitters.
No, that's right. That's right. You're exactly right.
I got to tell you, man, I was, I don't know if you ever went to that Wings place in Ashburn.
Many times.
We loved that place. And
many
so Tony and I went there for dinner one night. I think we had the girls with us and they had that back room. When you go in the front door over to the left was the back room where all the pinball machines were for the kids and the video games and stuff.
That's where we had our draft for fantasy football.
That's what I was getting ready to say. I looked back there and I started seeing familiar faces and there was Durst
right.
back there. I'm like, man,
that's
what's
right.
going on? And they said, oh, we're picking our teams. We're picking our teams.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Steve, how you been? He said, I ain't got time to talk to you now, Murph. I got to pick my teams here. I'll talk to you later, man. And he's,
that's right. That's,
he was focused.
He's focused. Oh, it's funny. But Boston was really interesting, though, because I had under me, I had Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, the Canadian border. I had the Lowell Lawrence task force, which call it a violent task force.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the financial investigations team, the FIT team. And we had two attorney general exempted operations. We were picking up millions of dollars from the Colombians undercover, laundering money via Boston, which a lot of people didn't even realize Boston was doing that. New York and Miami typically, and L.A. were the big players in that, but we were doing it up there, and it was interesting. I remember when I first got there, I was not a New England guy.
Yep.
In DEA, there's West Coast, there's
yeah.
Boston, there's New York crew, and then there's Miami crew. I was a Miami guy,
yeah,
right?
Yep.
And so when I got there, it was interesting. I was checking out some of the groups, and I went back to this enforcement group in the back, and there's like 50 boxes, and this guy's behind his desk, all packed and everything. And I'm like, what is that? He goes, oh, that's the Whitey Bulger case. And I'm like, really? I said, I honestly didn't even know that. I mean, I heard his name pop up a few times in smaller investigations. I did not know the significance of DEA's involvement in investigating Whitey Bulger. When he proceeded to tell me what he was up to and what they were doing. And so, you know, that was kind of fascinating to me. So I always kind of track that, but that was, he didn't report to me. That was an enforcement group under another ASAC, but it was interesting.
And that's what most people don't know is that the warrants out for Whitey Bulger were actually obtained by DEA.
That's right.
And the FBI, right. They had a very vested interest because one of their agents was, depending on what you believe, may have been working with Whitey Bulger.
That's
and
right.
I don't blame them for having that interest. That's embarrassing to the whole agency, but DEA was leading the way on that one.
Yeah. Yeah. The other story about New England that's interesting was I had a, up in Maine, we had an Indian reservation, and I had never been involved in an investigation or overseen an investigation as the boss of our Maine office investigating an online pharmacy on an Indian reservation. That
really?
Is complicated.
Yeah.
That is when I learned about the Bureau of Indian Affairs and that they actually have on the reservations, they have a chief and they have tribal councils and they have their own law enforcement. And it was an education that I needed and diplomacy to deal in that environment. It was amazing because we had to raid that place and we had to do it without letting everybody know and it became very complicated. That's all I'll say. It was
tribal land. It's a sovereign nation.
That's right. That's right.
It's funny because just about 2 weeks ago, Javi and I went to upstate Washington and spoke to a group of chiefs and sheriffs and some of their executive staff. We were in Anacortes, Washington, which is a beautiful little town up there, like kind of where Puget Sound comes out. I've never been to that part of the country. It was really pretty up there. But the chief that brought us up, our host, was the chief of the Swinomish Indian tribe.
Wow.
And he's gringo. And so I had a million questions for him.
That's interesting.
Grew up here in Central Florida, was over here at University of Central Florida. He was a cop. That's where he started as a university cop over there. Got his college degree. His wife, he met her at college, and she's from that part. She wanted to move back to her family. That's how he ended up in upstate Washington. But it was just an education to find out. One of my first questions was, and it's not a large tribe. You're talking, I think he said 11 to 1500 tribal members is all. But I'm thinking, and I asked him, I said, how do these Indians take it when a gringo comes in and tells them what to do and then puts them in jail? Said he's never had a problem. He's got the tribal councils behind him 100%. It's amazing. And I got to tell you, he doesn't have a big department, but he has some nice cars. They had nice equipment. Right. It's all provided by Washington under the Bureau of Indian Affairs.
That's right.
In fact, I'm going to bring him on here. His name is Earl Cohen. So we're going to bring Earl on because we've never had anybody from an Indian tribe to talk.
That'll be interesting. Interesting. Yeah. I'll definitely be listening.
Good stuff. Wow. And so apparently you did a pretty good job there in Boston because next you're getting made, aren't you?
Yeah, I got made. I remember the call. I was driving on the highway when Michelle Lenhart called me and said she wanted me to be the director of EPIC, the El Paso Intelligence Center, and the SCS Senior Executive Service bump. And honestly, I wanted that. I worked my whole career. You know how it is. So you have some agents who are happy being 13s. You have some that are happy being 14s and 15s. And I, from the very beginning, I knew I wanted to move through DEA, do the best job I could. And then if I was blessed and did a good enough job, wanted to get promoted. So I was proud of that.
Yep.
And went to EPIC. And interesting about EPIC in El Paso, Texas, on the Fort Bliss, my daughters will tell you today, they were in Mexico with me. Both my daughters were born in Peru, matter of fact, when I was doing that, when I was cross-pollinated. But they were in Mexico. They were like 7, 8, 9 years old. And they'll tell you the best time they ever had in all of my 10 moves was in El Paso, Texas.
No kidding.
They absolutely loved it. They were in like 6th, 7th, 8th grade. And the funny part of that, though, is you go to the school there, the private school that they went to, and you're in line to drop your kids off, and you're the only one with a Texas license tag. All the others are Mexican tags because they come in across the border in the morning and drop their kids off.
No kidding.
Yeah, they buy apartments in El Paso or homes. These are obviously the more well-to-do. And so they come across and they drop their kids off and go back and come back and get them at the end of the day.
Did they go to school with any cartel member kids?
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
I say no
that you
because know senior cartel, they typically, their kids went to the elite schools in Mexico,
okay,
the elite boarding schools. Even if they were in the border areas, they would go to the elite schools like in Mexico City that were boarding schools and things of that nature. So, but we had definitely trafficker kids. And EPIC was beyond belief. I went to EPIC not knowing a lot about EPIC, which was a good thing. But I do know when I got the assignment, I told Michelle Lenhart, because, you know, it's a DOJ center, really, right? Holder and Napolitano is DHS. Those are the two board of regents, basically, that oversee that DOJ center, right? And then I had a board. Michelle Lenhart chaired the board of 7 heads of the largest federal agencies represented at EPIC. There were 500 people, about 500 people from 26 federal agencies there. You know, all the IC was there, everybody. I went into there and I could not believe the capabilities that EPIC had. All I really knew about EPIC was local police can make a phone call and get some information on people they pulled over.
Yeah.
On the side of the road.
Yeah,
I mean, really, and then you would receive these EPIC alerts every now and then, but said, look out for, you know, drugs being smuggled and hubcaps on cars, you know, and things of that nature. I really had a naive thing. And I told Michelle, I said, well, the one thing I know when I go in, I'm going to take my DEA hat off and I'm going in as a taxpayer. Okay. I'm not doing this just for DEA. Too many agencies, too much at stake. And then I find out that EPIC has their fingers in everything.
Yeah.
The databases, all the aggregation of data, the license plate reader program, the AirBridge Air program, border. We were tied into that national border security system. And you know this from the center you ran. And it was all task force, and we had rail enforcement. I never even thought about trains coming in and out of the United States, right? There's trains every day coming in and out, people being, things being smuggled on them, people being smuggled in them. So they had DHS had their rail enforcement was there. FBI was there. They had some classified programs that were run out of there.
They were unbelievable.
Intelligence community operations, you know, all the IC, NGA, NRO, you know, NRO, National Reconnaissance, who fly, as we say, they fly the birds, they fly the satellites, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, they do the analysis of what NRO collects.
Yeah.
That's how it used to be. Now I hear it's all kind of meshed, which is good.
Well, it should be.
It should be. And I tried to do that, matter of fact, and I got in trouble. I tried to put the NRO office with the NGA office, and I got slapped hard for that. So
Unbelievable.
I thought it was kind of funny. But I would look down my hall at Epic, and down my from my office down the hall were like 11 offices, and there were 11 GS-15s sitting in those offices, each one representing their agency with a direct line to their director or administrator.
Yep.
So I would have meetings. And we would have meetings, and I'd say, don't run back to your office and call your administrator and say, Matt Addington said this.
Yeah.
I said, talk to me, please, first before you make a call. Because I would get calls from the head of agencies.
Oh, yeah.
They'd be like, Matt, did you really just say that you were going to do this or that? And I said, no, that's not really what I said, but this is what I meant. I'm, as a taxpayer, we need to do this. And well, we don't care about that. We care about our issues. And it was really interesting to deal with Washington, and I'd have to go up. I went up and briefed the National Security Council. I briefed at the White House, and my biggest issue was I wanted to expand EPIC.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted its capability to expand. So one thing I did, I brought in the IC. I thought it would be a great place for them to expand, to have more access, a footprint into the hemisphere, and use EPIC as the as that environment,
heck
that
yeah.
staging area. But then I took, I went with Napolitano. I reached out to her, and she was phenomenal. You know, the funny thing is, she was great for us. She gave me, she worked it so that they were going to give me $22 million, you know, to help expand EPIC. Matter of fact, Ruth Whipple Porter, another phenomenal person to work with. And she had this as part of one of her, as other duties assigned. I've never seen somebody that I had to give so many assignments to because she was so capable.
Yeah.
I always felt so bad, but she was just phenomenal. But so we got the money, and of course I get a call. Holder was upset. I think the comment was something to the effect, Matt, you're selling stock of Epic. You're selling Epic stock. We don't sell Epic stock. Because all of a sudden I had Napolitano from DHS thought it would be a good idea that Epic fall under them because they had the most people represented at the center. Then you had, who was the DNI? Clapper.
Yeah.
Clapper thought that it should be under the Director of National Intelligence, right?
Because it is an intel center.
And then we had, of course, Northern Command, NORTHCOM, JTF North were assigned there doing intel work to support some of their mission requirements. And all of a sudden, I heard that the four-star of NORTHCOM thought it should maybe be its own combatant command. So all this was happening, and I'm like, wow, because I was running around and I was briefing EPIC to everybody because nobody knew EPIC. Nobody knew really the true capabilities of the center. We were doing patterns of life support for packages for targeting of terrorists downrange. I'm like, really? I mean, there was so much capability. I think at peak time, we had 72 data feeds access to at EPIC. So, and I wanted to integrate all that data, and I wanted to set up a SCIF, and I wanted to take certain agencies represented most at EPIC and put some intel people and have them all sit together because we had rules about commingling data because agencies had various requirements, right?
Yeah.
Well, I said, you know what? That's great. We can honor that. But let's set up an intel center in a SCIF classified where these group of intel analysts can watch and monitor the aggregation of all that data together that would create these models of potential threat And the only time we would push that info out, when it was absolutely of absolutely immediate national interest, we would do that. And that we would have to make the big call to somebody to say, we've come up with this. So we would never violate the requirements of keeping the stovepipes amongst the agencies.
Yeah, you honor your memorandums of understanding
right,
with everybody.
And you are very versed in this, I know. But it was so frustrating to me because I got such pushback.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some people loved it, some hated it. The White House loved it. I went and briefed this and at the time, but the agency heads went crazy. So I'm at Epic for like, I don't know, a year and a half. And then I go on my leave. Now I'm right in the midst of all this. I've just gotten all this money to do a build out and everything. Created a, you know, shitstorm because I was thinking like a taxpayer. Imagine that, right?
Shame on you.
Yeah, shame on me. So I come home on home leave and I go to my brother's son's soccer game on a Saturday, and a family friend of my brother's and who I knew very well was there, this individual with his son is playing soccer. And he starts talking to me and he says, Matt, he goes, you know, you thought about moving on and retiring? And I said, yeah, sometimes, but not really. I was enjoying Epic. And he says, can you come to my office on Monday? I want to introduce you to somebody. And so I went. This was Blackbird Technologies. So I went to Blackbird on Monday, and Steve Pan and Peggy Steyer and David Moxley were the three founders. But I met with Steve Pan initially, just an incredible. These are some of the greatest patriots you could ever meet in your life, these individuals and everyone who worked at Blackbird. But he said, Steve says, we talked for like 10 minutes. He goes, I want you to come work for me. I'm like, well, what are you thinking about the job or whatever? He goes, don't worry about it. We'll figure that out. You know, and I'm like, well, I said, I don't know. And so he's like, well, he says, talk salary and money. Boom. Tells me, gives me a number. And I'm like, I'll make the call, start packing. So
that's an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah, yeah. And these were just great people, great patriots. And so I ended up, I had to call Michelle, of course, and let her know. And she was not very pleased, you know, because I told her, she'd asked me, Matt, I want you to give me a couple, 2 or 3 years there. Mm-hmm. And then we'll make sure you get taken care of, basically. She was very generous about it. So I felt bad, but in some ways I didn't, because it was time for me to leave. When you start to get frustrated in a senior leadership position and you're trying to do things and you have support, but at the end of the day, it's just not happening, you do get that sense that maybe it's time for me to move on and let others come in. Maybe they're more capable.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they have access I don't have. Maybe they'll be able to work the system better. I don't know. But I was like, it's my time to leave. I've given everything that I can. And so I left and I went to Blackbird.
Hey, too, when you're running a multi-agency, especially federal agencies, which you and I have both done, when I was the Special Operations Division, I made it up to ASAC there. I was the Special Agent in Charge Executive Assistant, which you see everything in that position and you see how challenging it is. And then the next thing you know, you're in that position where I had the OSDF Fusion Center, and all the agencies are coming in with their mandates, and they've all signed a memorandum of understanding as to how they will participate, and then they don't because they want to take advantage of all the other agencies in there. It's just herding cats doesn't even begin to explain what it's like working in that environment. It's extremely stressful. It doesn't matter what you say, how you say it, what you do. You're under a microscope every single freaking day. If you're out of the office for an hour, your deputy directors are wondering, well, what's he doing? Is he down there? Is he doing something against us? I mean, there's just so much conspiracy crap going on there that when I would have an executive staff meeting, I'd tell them, they would hit me with these things. And I said, tell me how you just serve the taxpayers of the United States today with that bullshit that you're coming up with there. It doesn't ingratiate you with your executive staff when you do that.
That's right.
But what you're talking about, when it gets so frustrating that you're ready to go, that's a shame. And ultimately, the taxpayers are the one that suffers and the bad guys win.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. But, you know, it was a great experience in it. And then, you know, I was ready to reinvent myself anyway. I already was predisposed to have a whole nother career. I was 48 years old. So I'm like, I'm going to reinvent myself and I'm going to create in this opportunity to go to Blackbird Technologies to work directly for one of the CEOs there, Steve Pan, just brilliant. And, you know, just surrounded by patriots doing whole covert pieces of operations supporting government activity in the intelligence community, downrange, you know, in the Middle East during the wars, doing operational support there. You'd walk around Blackbird and, you know, former SEALs, you know, SEAL team members walking around, generally SEAL team six guys, but a lot of SEAL team guys, Delta guys, you know, Orange guys,
Rangers, and the whole
Ranger, I mean, just everybody. And then a bunch of CIA type. And it was really phenomenal. We were doing, call it cyber, sensitive cyber work. Mm-hmm. We were doing tagging, tracking, and locating downrange during the war, where, you know, our devices were scattered about for covert activity, for tracking, you know, individuals, things. So it was really exciting times. It was all counterterrorism, counter-narcotics, counterintelligence work, and some law enforcement too. I mean, we were trying to also support, you know, DEA and other domestic missions and things with technology, advanced technology, very, very advanced. So I loved every bit of that.
So what you're doing today is shocking. You impressed the hell out of me after you and I caught up and I found out what you're doing. Go ahead and tell our listeners as much as you can, but without going, you know, too far.
Well, before I jump to that, because I left Blackbird real quick and I went to, we sold to Raytheon, Blackbird did. So I jumped to a DARPA company, which was very interesting. We were supporting DARPA's deep web, dark web program. So I actually, Gary Schiffman, a brilliant mind, I created Giant Oak. Yeah, and he had this relationship with DARPA, and we were part of their MEMEX program, doing creating a tool to search and hunt for bad people doing bad things. But another great opportunity. And then I moved on to Countertech, which was a cyber company, and now they're called Go Secure, executive vice president of that company. So at the end of that 2020 timeframe, I went in there like 2016. And I hope listeners, especially law enforcement listeners, and all of that I'm talking about, that they take away something before I talk about my current job. One is, you can always reinvent yourself. There's always life after.
Yep.
But most importantly, is don't sell yourself short on your value to the commercial world, to corporate America, to doing something else. Do not financially and personally sell yourself short. We're all so thankful for what we do, and we do it for nothing, right? All of this government service and law enforcement and police work, it becomes kind of identifies who we are. But yet we get into the commercial world, we get into the corporate world, and we take jobs, the first job that is thrown at us for a certain amount of salary, because we don't know how to negotiate salary. We're just thankful somebody wants to pay me to do that.
Okay.
And that's what we do. We say, okay, and I'll go in and I'll bust my ass. And then you get into those jobs and you look around and people with half the capability are making half more. And so I just want to make sure I got that out in all of this, is that we sell ourselves short.
And that's excellent advice for, especially for our law enforcement, our first responder, and our military community, because it applies to all three categories.
That's right.
Good advice.
So now let me jump. So now I'm, 2020. So I cross paths with this individual, Harry Sargent III, who was a big oil man, specifically bitumen and asphalt was where he really made his mark. An amazing individual, one of the best strategic thinkers I've ever, strategic negotiators too, that I've ever been around in my entire life.
Former U.S. Marine.
Former U.S. Marine fighter pilot and a Delta pilot, former Delta pilot too. Yeah, he did that for a few years when he got out. So, and he still flies to this day, which is pretty cool. Flies his own jet. But so I meet him through some mutual friends. I won't get into much detail on that.
Okay.
If he comes on here, I'll let him tell that story.
And there's a clue right there, ladies and gentlemen. He may be a future guest.
Yeah, that's right. So we basically are talking about South America, Latin America, talking about Bogota, we're talking about Venezuela, et cetera. And we decide, hey, maybe it would be great if I come and work for you. And he says, yeah, that'd be great. So I started working for him. The oil business It's trying to get operational rights to refineries, which we now have in Curacao. It's contracting ships to move our oil. It's finding purchasers or people that want to do JVs with us domestically for bitumen, which bitumen, by the way, is asphalt.
What's JVs?
Joint ventures. Joint ventures with us. So, I mean, we're always signing NDAs. We're always doing new contracts with potential shippers and buyers. And the team of, and this is Global Oil Management Group, by the way. So I'm the president of international affairs, but all that really means is I really work directly with the founder and chairman, Harry Sargent, and deal with a lot of things in Washington. I deal with a lot of the, we still have connections with other federal agencies because of the nature of the work. So I deal with that, and I'm with him all the time, listening, observing, offering my little pieces of advice based on my expertise around the world to help us make the best decisions possible when negotiating contracts and basically doing oil business. We're dealing with the Qataris. We're dealing with the Emiratis. We were in Bulgaria looking at a refinery there. We are, like I said, in Curacao. We are in Venezuela. You know, of course, there's a lot of issues with Venezuela and sanctions and things of that nature. So we're doing the best job we can right now in the best interest of U.S. business interests and the Venezuelan people, too. We'll see how that plays. I'm not going to get into that because it's way too complicated. But the bottom line is that, and let me backtrack. We're also in the lithium business. So we in Argentina, there's an area of the world called the lithium triangle. That's Bolivia, Argentina, and Chile. Mm-hmm. And some of the best lithium, condensed lithium product, brine is extracted from those regions. So we bought a bunch of salars, which are, call them fields, basically, in Argentina, in the Catamarca region. We were called Triangle Lithium, is the name of the company. Right now, we're still digging holes, because in the lithium business, when you're at the head, when you're digging holes, you're trying to extract based on PPM. You want 200 parts per million or 300 parts per million in order to kind of get in the money range, right? And then from there, obviously, you want 500, 800, 1,000 PPM is the best place to be. So we're in the process of doing that now as a lithium company also. And then you basically sell the product. And we're trying to do it green, too. That's something.
That's significant.
Yeah, well, there's a technology out there that we've partnered with a company called Direct Lithium Extraction, DLE. And it's a method to extract the lithium out of the brine and to basically cleanse the process so that you're not pushing contaminated water back into a lake bed near where your well is and stuff. So we're doing that. Even all of our work, even in the oil business, we're doing flare capture now. We have a joint venture with a flare capture company, and that's flaring is where you see the fire coming out of a gas pipe out in these fields. That's flaring, and what you want to do is there's carbon emission there. Now there's some technologies you can capture that carbon emission, so it's make it environmentally friendly. And we're getting involved in that. We're very cognizant of environmental needs and requirements out there in our business. A lot of people are critical of it, but guess what? Oil's not going away.
Right. So, right. Well, the big question is, can you get me like a discount card for gas and lithium batteries?
No. Well, yeah, I wish. It's interesting. We laugh because, I mean, obviously we're doing 50,000, 75,000, 100,000 barrel production in rates. So,
wow.
It's an interesting business, and we're dealing with the traders. I spend a lot of time traveling. We spend a lot of time in Geneva, Paris, London, because some of the big in Geneva is where, you know, some of the traders are. They're in London. These are the Gunvors, the Vitals and stuff. So you're always talking to them. You're always negotiating, but you know, it's interesting because when I look at the company, I'm Harry's son, Harry Sargent IV. The chairman is Harry Sargent III. Harry Sargent IV, just a brilliant, brilliant individual. In his he handles so much of the operations. You know, he's the true president of the company. Harry's the chairman. He's the president. Then we have people like me with international affairs. And then our general counsel is, we're a cast of characters. There's like five of us. And you've got Ali Rahman, who is just an amazing lawyer, amazing legal mind, brilliant individual. You know, he's the one you want to handle and looking at all the contracts and things of that nature. Harry Sargent, the son, is an operations guy who's finding the ships, moving the ships, controlling all of the operational requirements. It's fascinating to watch. And then Harry, is, as the strategic leader, is running around the world negotiating with sheikhs in the Middle East, presidents of countries, and things of that nature. So it's been an incredible experience for me. I'm going on almost 4 years now.
Wow.
And traveling all over the world. And there's a lot we're doing right now that I hope works out, because it's really exciting. It's exciting for the United States. These things work out for the prices of gas at the pump. So,
but I tell you what, I can't believe we've been talking for over 2 hours.
Oh, wow.
This has gone by so quickly. If you guys are interested in finding out more about Matt here, the only places I could find him was on LinkedIn under Matt Addington, Addington, and on X, formerly Twitter, under Matt_Addington. I couldn't find you anywhere else. Are you?
I haven't. And I think my X, I think it's been about 10 years since I've even opened that. So I have no social media. LinkedIn's pretty much the only conduit.
And that's the thing about this. My last question to you is going to be, what were the takeaways from today's conversation? But you gave us that to start with. And that's one of the most important ones that we could ever bring out on this show because of our listener base, is do not sell yourself short. You're valuable. You have things to offer. If you're a government service, like I was a cop since I was 19 years old until I retired in 2013. The things I get to do now, they're not financially, they're not on the scale, maybe not even globally. But doing things that I never dreamt I would be able to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't imagine that when your concern was going, possibly making it to the Olympic soccer team, did you ever dream that you'd be doing what you're doing now?
No, that's exactly right, Steve. And I tell this to everybody. I would have never imagined, first of all, the diverse career that I was so blessed to have in DEA, mm-hmm. but post-DEA.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been an executive in four companies, and now I'm in the oil and lithium business. I have reinvented myself because I pay attention and I study and I learn. And it's not because I'm anything special. It's because I think when you're in law enforcement or military or whatever, you're bouncing around. You don't realize you're not just in the military. You're not just in DEA. You're learning so many different ways of having to mold yourself into new jobs and new positions at completely different from what you may have been doing the year prior. We forget that. You have new assignments. You're reinventing yourself within your organization. So why do we think that we can't do that when we step out of that?
Absolutely.
And we retire into the corporate world? You have the capability, go after jobs, develop relationships, reach out to those individuals. Don't be shy that you've met along the way. And simply show up with the attitude that got you to where you were, to where you retire from, with that positive, hardworking, dedicated attitude, and you will get the job you want, and you will get the pay you want, because you will be important to that organization. People have to convince themselves of that.
And you know, the hard workers are, you encounter issues every day that you have to make decisions on and find ways to compromise and work around the obstacles that are thrown in front of you. Why would that not carry over into retirement? My staff, when I used to tell them, one of the things I probably said it too many times and made them sick of hearing it, but if you've got to the point where you don't think you can learn anymore, tell me, because I want you out. The drug traffickers, they are changing every day. We have to change. There's always something new you can learn. So
that's right.
That's some of the best advice that any guest on this show has ever given here. I appreciate that, Matt. Having you on here now, I think, I'm glad you mentioned your daughters. I think the last time I saw them, they were maybe 5, 6, 7 years old. It's been a lifetime ago.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
Knowing that you're in Florida now and we're in Florida, I missed you this week. This is how busy Matt was. We were going to do his interview this past Monday. Today, we're actually doing this on a Friday. And he called me on Friday or Saturday the week before and said, listen, I got to go out of country. And the sad part of that was not that he was going out of the country, but Javier and I spoke at Florida International University this past Wednesday. And the guy that brought us in is Brian Fonseca with the university there. I was working on my master's degree at FIU when I was stationed in Miami with DEA. He's brought us in three times now. And I know you're close friends with him. He's close friends with Harry. Just we have so much in common. Thought we were going to get to see each other again, but I got to ride the Brightline for the first time ever and love that. It will be my primary transportation to South Florida now.
I ride it all the time.
Yep. So when you're in Orlando, if you come to Orlando and you have a few minutes and you don't call me, I'm going to call your wife. I'm calling Amy, your wife.
I will definitely reach out. Yeah. It's that's funny. Brian's a great guy. Yeah.
He is.
All the worlds collide. I run into people. Like I had to go the other day when I had to cancel on a show. I've been to Bogota, Colombia like three times now.
Wow.
I just came back yesterday from Bogota, I think. And I'm still running into, old friends and things at the embassy. It's very interesting because we're dealing with national companies of governments, oil companies associated with the governments, like Colombia, it's Ecopetrol, things of that nature. So we're always bouncing around Latin America building these, but I always make it a point to pop into the embassy and say hello to old friends or people that I know.
Yep.
So you know, it never dies.
Man. Brother, it's been an honor having you on here.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving us your time. Thanks for being so transparent about your story, the involvement that you've had, not only with law enforcement, with the intel community as well. And just, seriously, just taking the time to tell everybody, love the advice at the end. If there's anything I can ever do for you, you and I are going to be much closer now that we've reestablished contact like this.
Fantastic.
Yep,
yeah, and I would also say if anybody wants to reach out to me, feel free to reach out. A lot of people reach out to me anyway about kind of career advice or
there you go.
What I think. My door's always open for all of us. We're all brothers and sisters.
That's part of the brotherhood and sisterhood. We retire does not mean that our oath expires. So
that's exactly right.
Matt, brother, thank you so much,
all right,
man.
Thank you.
For all our listeners. Join us next week. I'm not going to tell you who next week's guest is going to be because I'm not real sure who it is. No, I know who it's going to be. But thank you for joining me again here on Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. We'll see you next week.
Thank you, Steve.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I can't thank you guys enough for taking the time to see and hear some of the best true crime content you can find anywhere. I know none of this would be possible without your support, and I don't take that very lightly. You keep me motivated to find the best guests out there so we can all hear their tales of bravery and daring do. You know, and I'm extremely proud of the guests that come on the show. Their willingness to be so transparent and honest about their lives and experiences. You know, before each episode, I ask the guest if there's anything they don't want to talk about. 99% of the time, they tell me nothing is off the table with them. I can ask anything. In fact, the only time they ask me not to mention something, like where they live or maybe please don't show their faces, is because they are still receiving death threats because of some of the courageous and unbelievable acts they were involved with. These are real-life heroes, ladies and gentlemen. People just like me and you with families who risk their very lives to protect and defend all of us every single day. You've probably heard the saying, real heroes don't wear capes, right? That's who I'm talking about. These studs and studettes, they don't wear capes and they don't parade around like fictional superheroes that we see on the movies or on TV. Our heroes wear uniforms, body armor, bulletproof helmets, knife-resistant gloves, gun belts. They carry handguns, long guns, stun guns, anything that they can find to help protect themselves and us. Just think about that for a second. Does your job, does your career require any of this? Thank God we have men and women willing to make these sacrifices and do these jobs. And thank God for their families as well. I refer to them as our unsung heroes. They keep life running on the home front, not really knowing if their husband, wife, child, brother, sister, whoever, if they'll make it home at the end of their shift or the end of their tour. You think that might cause a little tension around the house, a little stress, anxiety, post-traumatic stress syndrome, maybe even thoughts of suicide? It takes a special person to tolerate and endure that. They do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Now, a quick side note here. Regardless of who you are, if you or someone you know is struggling with any of these conditions, conditions like overwhelming stress, anxiety, hopelessness, PTSD, please don't think you're alone. If you need someone to talk to and you don't know where to turn, there's the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. All you have to do is dial or text 988. That's it, 988. Their lines are manned around the clock every day of the year. They'll find someone, a professional, for you to talk to and get the support you need. Again, it's just dial 988. One other thing about our guests that I find so admirable is the fact that they didn't stop serving once they retired. Almost all, if not all of them, continue to serve others in some capacity after retirement, don't they? I have a saying that applies here. Just because we retire, that doesn't mean our oath's expired. Is that a little corny? Yeah, sure is. But that's the way most of these heroes feel. It's their creed, their mantra, to keep doing good things for other people. So to all our guests here on Game of Crimes, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for your service to our communities, to our countries, and for taking the time to tell us about your adventures. To you, I say, job well done, brothers and sisters. May God bless and protect all the men and women in law enforcement, our military, and all our first responders. Now, if you like this week's episode, head on over to Apple or Spotify and hit those 5 stars for me. It only takes you a minute, and it really helps support the show. If you didn't know this already, Game of Crimes is now on YouTube. Just type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar at the top and see what you think. And while you're there, do me a favor, click on that subscribe button, the like button if you'd like, and feel free to share that with all your friends. You can send me your comments on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or to my email address, which is gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. My website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. This is where you'll find all our episodes, books written by some of our guests, some merchandise, and more. On Facebook and Instagram, you can find me at Game of Crimes Podcast, and on X, type in Game of Crimes. Also on Facebook, now you got to check this out. Go to Game of Crimes Fans and join the best private group on the Facebook platform. This group is run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato. She's the lady that rules with an iron fist, but she does wear a velvet glove. And if you're looking for even more content, go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. There you'll find bonus episodes each month ranging from serious and current topics to some silly and fun events. And you can get early access audio to each week's interviews before they drop on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. And I'm talking those are free of commercials, commentary, and music. You just hear the podcast. You can even subscribe for free on patreon.com/gameofcrimes and hear the first 5 minutes of each episode to help you decide if you'd like to spend some of your hard-earned cash to hear more. Again, that's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Do me a huge favor. Tell your friends about Game of Crimes. Invite them to check out the show. I appreciate you helping me spread the word about the best weekly true crime podcast out there. Am I a little biased? Yeah, probably. As I mentioned earlier, your support, and I mean this is what keeps me going. One last thought. It's okay for us to have different ideas and different opinions, but it doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends, okay? Finally, thanks for joining me to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next week.
into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.